On today's episode, we sat down with two of Jonathan's closest friends, Tommy and Caitlin, who both were in attendance at the trial. They will be discussing how they found out about Jonathan being killed, the days they spent with the Cruz family afterward, and their observations about Brenda and Jonathan's relationship. We touch on their thoughts about the evidence, the witnesses, and the jurors as they both had a seat in the galley. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this episode are the speaker's own.
On this episode, we've asked two of Jonathan's friends to come on and bring us through the tragedy of Jonathan's death and also the trial. I have Caitlin and Tommy with us today, and really, we appreciate your time so much coming on and going through the most traumatic thing that could happen to a friend. And Caitlin, I'm going to start with you because you and I have spoken before. I want to know how this affected your life and where you are now with it.
So I've had this conversation a couple of times with people close to me, and the way it has affected us is she took away our what ifs. Now, we obviously still move on. We have our lives now. I'm married. I have a son who's now 2 going on 3. Emily and Jacob married. They have 2 sons. You know, Tommy is thriving in his professional career. So life still moved on. The difference is our what if was taken from us. So what if Jonathan was still around? You know, I could see him on the floor playing with Emily and Jacob's kids. I could see him at both Emily and Jacob's wedding and my wedding. You know, the phone calls, the inside jokes, the, hey, I need you for something, and him responding with, I'm there, tell me what you need. So that was taken. It was all traumatic, and it's just, it never goes away. There's not a day that we don't think about it. It's kind of like a broken plate. It can still function as a plate, but the chip is still missing and it's never whole. It's something that affects our lives forever.
Tommy?
I think it's harder for me because I left for college when, you know, knowing Jonathan, and, you know, we've kept in touch, and I, you know, one of my highlights of coming home was seeing them, and he was the first person I would say, I'm here. And then first person, the last person I would say, you know, goodbye, I'll see you soon. When I left for college or back to New York, where I was at, there are occasions, you know, driving, or when there's difficult situations where I want to talk to someone, he was the best friend that I would talk to and say, I wish I could talk to you and just hear his jokes and just silly remarks that just makes you change your point of view. That's kind of the gap that I see today, is not having that person that I grew up with, I knew, you know, who knew me, call me out on stuff and vice versa, just to talk to. It's hard because I drive by very familiar places that, you know, we hung out at or we wanted to do. And it's just been difficult from that perspective. You know, it's just really staying connected with the Cruz family, hanging out with Danny. We live kind of our younger years and just, you know, have him kind of be in that presence in that room when we hang out. So
in a million years, Caitlin, you're in the industry of answering people at their worst moment, a 911 call. Did you ever think that you would have a friend who was violently killed?
No, it's not ever. I mean, I know that there's always a possibility I'll take a call from somebody I know. I have taken calls from people I know. I've taken calls where somebody called me up and said that they had just stabbed their girlfriend. I've taken calls where somebody's like, my baby's not breathing. You get through it, but never did I think that a situation like this, where one of my friends was taken from us, would happen.
Hearing from Caitlin and Tommy, I didn't think I'd have tears in my eyes in the first 3 minutes of this Zoom, but I did. And it just seemed like Jonathan was everybody. best friend. And it seemed like, and correct me if I'm wrong, he was a guy's guy, but he was also a girl's guy. Like, he really could vibe with anybody in any situation, from, you know, broing out with Tommy and Andrew and Jacob to, you know, shopping with Caitlin and Emily and Danny. It just seemed like he was everybody's everything. And the things that you described about your friendship with him were really meaningful. And I know what it's like to have somebody pass away and you have that closeness yet with their family, because it is still that strong connection that you are sharing a common denominator that you can talk to forever and not be judged by other people who haven't gone through the same thing and can't go, oh my God, you're still talking about this person. Yes, he is a big part of my heart forever.
And don't get me wrong, Jonathan and I's relationship was a little extreme with the one-upping each other, trying to piss each other off, seeing basically who would be the first to wave the white flag.
That's what I was going to say is, Caitlin, you could throw down with Jonathan, if I remember correctly, and you guys butted heads, and he tried to do things that would really set you off.
It was very much like, I mean, he has a sister who he absolutely loves and adores, but I was like the sister that he wanted to make go crazy, and I would give it back to him just as much. At that time, I worked day shift, and I would just have to get up real early. Well, him and the boys would be out, and then all of a sudden, I'd hear all of them come back into the apartment. And it would be Andrew, Jacob, and Jonathan laughing hysterically, trying to come up with a plot, not knowing they were loud, and I'm already up at this point. And it would be, who's going to barge into my room naked constantly? And it was like a rotating schedule. Okay, Jacob did it last time. It's going to be Jonathan this time. And I just remember waking up, hearing them. So I was like, not this time. I sat in front of my door and waited for them to come on in. And as soon as they opened that door and realized I was there, they all screamed like little girls and ran away.
I love that.
So I can rephrase my previous point to saying he was a guy's guy, he was a girl's guy, and he was the little brother that never went away, yet you still love him. So
pretty much, yeah.
I would say he was the perfect person to go to because he was just silly. That's all he cared about, being silly. And during that time, that silliness, whatever it is, you forget everything else. And I think that's what is, I think we miss with Jonathan, is like, we can spend time, be silly, and forget all about the craziness that's around the world. Time seems to freeze when we're around with them and we're just having a good time. And that's what life should be about.
And you could never make him mad. Every time I tried to pay him back for what things he did to me. I remember one time he was asleep on our pullout, and when Jacob and I were living together, and I had those little poppers that you get around the 4th of July where you can just kind of throw them on the ground and they pop. So I thought, this will be funny. I'll throw a couple at his back and wake him up that way. Well, he slept through it. And the next morning he woke up and he's like, why do I have all these welts on my back? And, you know, Jacob told him, and he's like, good try. I could never get him.
That's a great point, though, that he was not someone you could make mad.
No, it took a lot. And if he even showed a moment where he was getting upset or frustrated, it was easy for him to rebound, redistract himself, and move on to something else, because he had an overall just cheerful, fun-loving personality.
That's a good way to pivot into the situation. He did not hold anger in. So let's go into how the story of that night unfolded from Brenda. Let's go into it. Do you feel that he, in a relationship, he did not react in the way that she said that he did?
When you heard that Jonathan had committed suicide, what was your initial reaction?
I thought it was a joke, quite frankly. I was in India at that time. I received a call from the family telling me that, hey, you know, Jonathan is no longer here. And I just was like, why are we playing this joke? I'm busy. I'm with my development team. I got work to do. And they just kept saying it over and over. And I didn't believe it, quite frankly. And after we had a discussion, and hung up on the phone, I still didn't believe it. And it was went to bed just thinking about it, hearing that news, and I still didn't believe it. And it came to a point when the workday started, and I was with my team, and I told them I had to go home because of this happened. That's when I burst into tears, and I don't know why it happened at how it happened like that. But for me, knowing, hearing what Jonathan allegedly did, didn't seem like it could be possible, knowing who he is and the type of person he is. It was a very impossible thing to do for Jonathan to do. And it didn't hit home until I was at home with the Cruz's family, at the house with all these people running around and things like that. So
Kaylin.
Mine was a little different and weird. I was supposed to be at a Super Bowl party with Emily, with Jacob, with a friend of ours, Chris, and his wife. And Jonathan was supposed to go to the Super Bowl party with us. A couple of days prior, I had a bad dream. And in my dream, I just remember crying and telling Andrew, we can't go through this again. We can't relive this. And I called him up and I was upset. And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. Come fly out here. Just spend a couple of days with me, whatever. Because Andrew and I had experienced the loss of a friend about a year prior. And it was devastating. And we were still feeling the effects of it. So I went out to flew to San Diego, where Andrew was living at the time. And we both had fun. We went to bed to a phone call. And I ignored it. I knew who it was. I thought, that's weird. Why is this person calling me at this odd hour? So I ignored it, and then it immediately rang again. And I immediately knew something was wrong, and it was Jonathan. And so I answered the phone, and he said, are you with Andrew? I need you to be with Andrew. And I said, is it Jonathan? And he said, yes. And I immediately went, handed the phone to Andrew, and I said, I can't. I know what this is. I can't do this again. And then my dream popped back up into my memory. Andrew came and got me, and he said that Jonathan was gone, that they're saying that he shot himself. And of course, with the line of profession that I'm in, I had 10,000 questions. And of course, none of them could be answered. You also kind of want to respect the privacy of his family, even though we're all close, but Andrew and I were talking about it. Like, that's nothing he would do. That's not the type of person he is. Plus, if he was the type of per if he did do this, he wouldn't have done it in the manner that it was done in. All these questions started circulating, and just it didn't feel right. It didn't feel, it felt like there was more to it that we had yet to uncover.
Did you know about Jonathan's relationship with Brenda? I know you hadn't met her, but did you know anything about it?
I knew that he was in a relationship with Brenda. I knew that he had feelings for her prior, but was wishy-washy because she was friends with Danielle first, and things like that. But to me, Jonathan would get into relationships and get out of relationships really fast. He would fall hard, and then he would go above and beyond. Like, he was the type of doting boyfriend that you would want. A couple of the girls, though, their main complaint was is that he was so overbearing because he was always there. He never gave them room. They asked, hey, let's go out to dinner, thinking we'll just drive through McDonald's. And then he was taking them to a lobster buffet and buying $300 bottles of wine. Like, that's just how he was. He treated them like a queen. And he went through a bunch of different girls, but he would always get over them and always go on to another one and fall hard into a relationship, always throwing out the love word, always throwing out, I think this is the one. So I knew about her, but nothing had ever resonated that this is serious. She's the one. This is his going to be the partner for the rest of his life kind of thing. It was, let's wait and see what happens. This is only 3 months in.
I've never met her. Like Kaylin said, he had a lot of number ones, and it was like, okay, great. He'll always make sure that this person, like whoever he's going out with, you know, the family was okay with her. His friends were okay with her. If it's not, that was a huge red flag for him, because that's who he's surrounded with, and that's how he got through his day to day, is with his family and friends. And if someone's going to interfere with that, that's when he would be like, all right, time to move on, because that could be a fit. Because if you'd fit in his it with his friends and family, it wasn't worth his time. And that's why I think I loved and respect about Jonathan. But yeah, I did meet her. The first time I met her was when I landed in India. I landed back to Texas, went to the Cruz's family, and she was there. And that was the first time I've ever met her.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Okay, let's talk about when you met her. You arrive at Jonathan's house, and obviously there's a lot of grief. You walk in, where was Brenda? What was going on?
So it was just because there's a lot of family in the house. They were just hustling, bustling, you know, say hi. I remember her sitting on the couch, kind of bundled up and just looking down, not talk to anyone. I think Danielle introduced me to Brenda. I didn't know of her, so I didn't expect anything, but it didn't feel right when she didn't even look at me in the face to say hello. You know, shook hands, and she just basically went back upstairs. So there was something that just didn't feel right when I first met her, quite honestly. She didn't really help out the family. And the more I learned about this, you know, that they've only dated 3 months, she was more in pain than the rest of the family, which is ridiculous.
Did you know the circumstances when you met her?
No, I did not. I knew that he was shot and that was it. I didn't know the full story around that. Thought she was just his girlfriend at that time, and she's sad that, you know, just as a supporting girlfriend. So it was just very odd that she was the way she was acting didn't align where I would respect someone that was dating Jonathan for a couple months or in a relationship for a couple months.
When did you hear the circumstances?
I couldn't tell you. Just coming home from India, because I was there for a year, and the whole week was really being at the house, trying to help them, and leading up to the funeral. It's been a blur.
I think it was actually a day or two after, because Andrew and I landed, and then we went to the Cruz's house, and I think it was Tommy, myself, Andrew, Jacob, and Emily there, and we were talking without his family present. And that's kind of when we all started asking information. And Danielle, I believe, was the first one that said the location of where he was shot. And that was when we all started talking, going, this doesn't make sense, and started asking more questions. And that's when I know Pam started giving us a little bit more information.
Your training probably kind of clicked in a little bit, where you know the right questions to ask. The location, you said the location. What about the location that made you ask more questions?
Most suicide calls that I get that involve gunshots, especially males that know guns, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to make sure that they don't have a chance of survivability. So they're going to go for a headshot. And especially knowing Jonathan and his involvement, his knowledge of guns. As soon as I heard that it was an abdomen shot, I immediately knew that he did not, and it's 100% in my mind, that he did not commit suicide. Now, there was more questions that I still had to kind of figure out in my mind or try to make sense of what happened. I started leaning towards the obvious of the only other person in the apartment with him.
So you both knew that Brenda was there at the time. Like, you didn't know all the circumstances, but is it fair to say you both had heard that Brenda was there when he was shot?
Not in the initial phone call from his family to let us know that Jonathan had passed, but definitely by the time that we had landed, Andrew and I had landed in DFW, and we started connecting with everybody close to Jonathan and his close circle came together. That's when we started uncovering more information, because one person would have heard one thing, another person heard another thing. So we all just kind of information shared, and we were trying to put all the pieces together, because in our minds, this did not make sense. There was something wrong. It was our attempt to find peace in the matter, find understanding as to how this could happen.
Were you aware of what happened earlier in the day when he went to brunch with Jacob and Emily, that there had been the incessant phone calls and texts and the conversation that Brenda had with Emily about, you know, that's my man, you're disrespecting? Did you guys know any of that in the initial first days?
I knew maybe 2 to 3 days later. I know Emily and Jacob were not answering their phone calls that day. Or I would get a, I'm too upset to talk right now, I can't talk right now. Later that night, while I was still in San Diego, I was able to talk to Jacob a little bit more and get some information. And that's, he had painted the picture of that day they went to brunch and, you know, something had happened. And
as the friend of Jonathan, you're looking for justice. You're looking for answers like everybody else, and you want your day in court too. How was it going through that process?
All of us knew in our hearts of hearts that Jonathan didn't kill himself. It was more of just solidifying to everyone else that Brenda was the killer, and that was it. So it was just a matter of time on when that information was going to gets exposed to the public.
Caitlin?
I expected it wouldn't go right away. Just kind of having a little information with everything. I knew that they weren't getting a criminal trial, but that's a whole other topic. So it was kind of frustrating, but I know that civil process can be.
The very first day when you're sitting there and Brenda and her family walks in, initial reactions?
It was more of, today's your day. The truth's come out and that's it. I don't know, you can't hide anymore. This is it. Your moment where we're gonna showcase who you are in this world.
I picked up Jacob, and Jacob and I drove down together. It's kind of a support thing too. Plus Emily was testifying, so the two-car situation, you know, and us being all friends, helping each other out as best we could. So I pulled into the garage, and as I pulled into the garage and was looking for a parking spot, there she was. And she was walking in like she didn't have a care in the world. I had never met her in person, but obviously had seen plenty of photos. And I just, a cold just fell over me. And there she was walking in like she was about to go take care of a parking ticket. I mean, it's, she had no emotion, nothing. I know personally, if this was me, I would need to be on some form of heavy narcotic just because of the pure emotions running through me. But she didn't have a care in the world. She just walked in with her husband and that was it.
When you saw her in court, you know, there were those long embraces with her husband, Jason, where I think for a whole break, he held her for almost half an hour, and the rubbing the back and her, like, you know, her face in his shoulder. And was that in opposite to how you saw her in the parking garage and walking into court?
No, it was an absolute joke. The reason she was hiding her face is because she had no emotions. And so she was trying to hide the lack of emotions. So let me bury my face into my husband's chest so that nobody can see that I'm cold.
Right. I wanted to point that out. And I know, Caitlin, you and I talked at the trial. You saw her, if I recall right, you saw her again in the parking garage. And I had asked you, was she embraced by Jason at that time or holding hands? And I thought you said no, that they had been walking separately apart. So it's like, are they putting on a show for the court and the galley and the judge that they're in this, you know, wonderful embraced relationship and he's protecting her, yet they get out to the parking garage and things are different?
Yeah, they were walking separate, but I mean, side by side. Like, there was no loving embrace. No, he wasn't having to support her to the car because she was so emotional. You know, I can just kind of recall times that I've been extremely upset, even in cases of this whole Jonathan situation. And, you know, you're overcome with emotion. You're weak at the knees. It's hard to do anything, especially if I'm going to be on trial and they're sitting there accusing me of murdering my boyfriend at the time. Like, there would be no way that I'm walking out of there on my own 2 feet, let alone not have red eyes, mascara running everywhere. You know, if she had on waterproof mascara, I need to know what it was, because there was, her makeup was still superb through the whole thing. So I don't know what that was.
Tom Shaw laid out and did a superb job by the timeline, asking question after question. For me, I would be a mess if somebody asked me about my now deceased loved one, love of my life. When you're listening to the timeline and hearing what happened to Jonathan, I was sitting in the galley on the same row. I would look over at you all, and frankly, you all showed more emotion throughout that than Brenda did. It was heart-wrenching to see the friend group just devastated. I didn't feel like she was devastated.
No, especially, I mean, I know her story changed several times, but what didn't ever waver was the fact that she said that she was there. So if somebody is sitting there accusing you of stuff or painting a timeline to a situation, a traumatic situation that you were there and witnessed firsthand, I mean, and I know everyone grieves differently, but I would have expected a sniffle. I would have expected a head tilt, something to indicate a little bit of discomfort. I know I'm over emotional, so you may not get the uncontrollable sobs that I give, but just something in a change of demeanor. And that was just never seen. The only time I saw her shift her demeanor was on one question that was asked about Emily. And that's when her true self came.
What that is interesting, because we noticed on one question that she reacted. But what was the Emily one?
The Emily question that she reacted to, she had been stone cold through the whole thing, pleading the fifth. But the one question that her true self slipped and came back was the question where they're reading the text messages back and forth. And she basically said that she would come up there and handle her. I can't remember the exact terminology, but basically some form of physical violence against Emily. And that's when you could see the switch in her eyes, and she kind of flipped her hair and she moved. She was a human for that millisecond. And then quickly went back into her robotic self.
I think the one question that I took note was the phone dropping into the toilet. She shook her head. That was her story. That was not anybody's story but hers, that she dropped it into the toilet. I want people to understand this, because I've been there. This encompasses this, every bit of this changes your life being in a courtroom and hearing these things and knowing deep down that Jonathan did not shoot himself, that someone else shot him, and there's no justice. I want you guys to discuss hearing the evidence, getting the verdict, and where we are now.
There were two moments. It was when Brenda was on the stands and she and I looked at each other in the eyes. And that was the first time I just looked into, quite frankly, pure darkness. I was like, this is not right. Her eyes were dark just like mine. And I looked in and I saw nothing. That just solidified the fact of the type of person she is and someone that could do this or harm other people. In the second moment, it was a picture of Jonathan laying dead. And that was the first time I've seen any of that or heard about that. It's like, how could a monster do this to someone that loved life so much? Those are the two big points that keep coming into my head. Leaving the court, it's just made me not believe in people or trust in people as I would like to. There's people out there that could hurt people to this extent. It also allowed me to appreciate the people that I have around me to in the aspect that we can't take every day for granted because we don't know. Like we don't know if we can get that call. That's the fear, quite frankly.
Caitlin?
As great as it was to get the answers on a civil trial, obviously civil is mainly financial and it's not about the money. So it was great, though, hearing the guilty. And then it was great hearing the, yes, we think that she owes this because of this, because of this, because of this. To me, it's still not over. She's out there and she's living her life. She got married. She's had kids. Yes, I would hope that she still thinks about this daily, but she still gets her future, you know, and I can't help but think, you know, I go back to the whole, she took away everybody's what ifs. It was a ripple effect. Jonathan's future wife will have never have met him because she took him away. Jonathan's future kids will never be because she took him away. You know, and what kind of future did they have? While it was great to be vindicated in that way, it's still the emptiness of she's still out there. There's no criminal conviction on her, whether or not there ever will be. And it's just that empty feeling of we failed. We failed him. Like, we're always going to keep trying. We're always going to keep pushing. But the police, Brenda, like other people that Brenda had affected before Jonathan, and that nothing was done. It just leaves a empty, sick feeling in you.
You don't feel like there will ever be justice in the criminal world?
Honestly, I always have that slim hope. But at some point, the longer and longer things go, I think it would take something major. I would think that it would take her to confess. I would think it would take her to confess to her husband, who then would bring information out. The longer and longer it goes, more and more evidence gets released, more and more evidence goes without being collected, solved. I don't want to ever shut that door completely because she did it. And if she were just to come and say, I did it, I can't live with this anymore, then yes, there would be. But as far as right now with the judicial system and the people in their places that they are, that they hold, I don't see any movement.
I'm going to say there will be justice, but not in the world right now, today.
Yes. Yeah. I think had there been different people in certain elected positions and certain spots, and luckily if somebody else is put in that, then there's a shot that they may reopen it or relook at it. But right now with the current people, the current situation.
I'll agree.
I just wish that we could see it on that final judgment when she's standing before God and she has to atone for all that or ask about that. And there's no hiding.
When Brenda's attorney presented his side, at any point did it make you pause or think, wait a minute, things could be different?
I went into court to understand, look, there's always two sides of the story. I'm always open to that, right? And I listened to both stories, both sides, just kind of close my eyes and just hear the facts, hear what was presented. It all came to the same conclusion. What Tom presented to the court is undeniably proof that she killed him. Things don't add up, and I will always have hope that she will be in jail, but it's not in our timeline to discuss. Like, the timeline for this little trial is different. She took her way, or what is. We took her way of living life, quite frankly, because now she has to look over her shoulders and see and cringe if a cop comes by that is for her, right? So she can't live life. She's just going through the motions as a soulless human being. And I feel so sorry for the kids that she has to take care of and the husband has to take care of, because she's now not ruined her life. She's ruined their lives.
What kind of surprised me is sitting there hearing his side trying to defend her. No, it never wavered what I think. I think she pulled the trigger. You can't convince me any other way. The motive, the means, the reason why can all change. But who was the trigger woman? It was Brenda. But seeing her mother-in-law and father-in-law sit right behind her, hearing all these things, what I'm assuming would be the first time, you know, that plays doubt in their minds. I mean, and like Tommy said, if that was my child, I would have some severe concerns. Plus the contrast of what they were trying to prove with 3 months in, and she was controlling, and these rolling of emotions, and these, you know, the passion, the fire in her of trying to fight any woman that came within 100 feet of Jonathan, then to stone cold pleading the fifth, no emotions whatsoever. I mean, it's a Jekyll and Hyde going on there. No matter what her side was presenting, it didn't change what we truly believe.
So you mentioned Jason's parents or her in-laws being in court. What did you think of the fact that her parents or sisters or friends were absent from the trial? Did that cause any red flags for you? Did you guys think about that aspect, that she really had nobody but her husband and her in-laws?
It didn't cause red flags for me, because if I was on trial, I honestly wouldn't want anybody there either. Because you know what's going to be shown, you know what's going to be said, and none of it was good on her side. The jealousy, the rage, you know. So no, it didn't surprise me that there wasn't anybody there. Plus her stories always change about her family and what's going on. So who knows? It did surprise me that his parents were there. I think that you might want to hide them and shield them from that too. Because like we've both pointed out, there's always that seed of doubt in there. I mean, you can't look, whether or not you think that she's innocent, you can't look at those messages that went back and forth after 3 months. You can't sit there and look at the ever-changing stories that she's had. You can't sit there and look at, you know, the expert witnesses that testified and think, nope, there's no way she did that. Plus, all of this now is public record on the internet. I mean, it's a Google search, and her kids one day will Google her and see everything. And how are you going to explain that?
I do appreciate you all giving us the victimology, telling us about Jonathan and how it's affected your life. Caitlin, I know you're involved in law enforcement, and the work you do is right in the trenches of this, and you will see other families go through it. I think the trauma of it's going to always be with you. Tommy, I know the work you do. You try to reach out and make a difference in people's lives.
There's never going to be a time that we aren't willing to talk about him and share his story and share the, how many lives he touched. I mean, he deserves justice one way or another. And like you said, I mean, the constant pressure. I am a full believer that you can't keep a secret only to yourself. You're gonna tell somebody.
If you or someone you know is dealing with suicidal ideation or is actively thinking about taking their life, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. Without Warning Podcast, available now on all major podcast platforms.